there are dishes where I cook that I'm looking to invoke certain emotion. There are some that I truly want them to question the food itself. And then there is food that I cook to tell a story.
I think authentic is what you want to cook. And that's what you want to serve. And this is what you want to present. And that's your craft.
Today, everything is a business. When I go out to eat, what am I getting? Sustenance? Sure. But also the personality and experiences of the people that created the dishes I ate. How should we engage with something as personal, as intimate as food, as a business? What are people selling and what are people paying for? I'm Brian Lowry, professor at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. In this podcast series, Know What You See, I talk to people from a wide range of backgrounds about their own experiences with race and power. I've been thinking a lot about food this season, especially food as a way to journey into history, whether it's our families, our cultural heritage, or world events. These discoveries tell us about the value we place on certain cuisines and people, sometimes without thinking about how it affects our mindset. My interviews with author Von Diaz and artist Tunde Wei, we talked about the question of authenticity when it comes to food, and the unequal value placed on cuisine from places like Puerto Rico or Africa or the American South in favor of dishes with European roots. This week, I'm talking with two restaurant owners, both serving dishes inspired by their personal histories and ethnic heritages, about the business of making and selling food.
My name is Eva. I'm a chef here in Toronto.
Eva Chen was most recently the executive chef at Kojin Momofuku. The restaurant was all about cooking with open fire. Eva drew on her Samoan, Singaporean, and Chinese heritage, as well as her upbringing in Hawaii, to put her own spin on the menu.
I was born and raised on the farm. Our livelihood was what we grew, what we raised, you know, what we produced, what we have to kill. So to be surrounded by a culture like that, where we constantly go out to fish, go out to harvest, to plant, to sell, you know, it becomes like a language.
Eva learned a lot about cooking and technique from her grandmother, who owned the farm Eva grew up on, and who at the time was one of the few non-Japanese sushi chefs on the island. Working in kitchens all through her childhood, those skills ended up being her ticket to see the world.
And so when I traveled, it was the easiest way to find a job. It was in a kitchen. You know, my first job in the kitchen was 16. I was washing dishes, and that's always just become a livelihood for me.
Making her way through Asia to Australia, Europe, and Norway, Eva finally found a home in Toronto. All those years traveling and working in so many different kitchens helped her form a perspective on food and her own identity.
I think traveling first and foremost puts you in a very uncomfortable zone. That's the number one thing that I love and I'm scared of every time. It allows you to see the community, the new community you're in the eyes of a minority, as a foreigner, as an outsider. It really pushes you to learn the different cultures and what you can find in common. I learned about myself from learning about the culture and the food wherever I was at that time. You know, I think mostly in Southeast Asia, there were situations where I felt extremely privileged, even though I looked like the locals, even though I felt like I was a local. I was also not. And the sense of heritage I grew up with when I went to visit, you know, my family's native lands was very different from what I perceive as authentic and not. So it was a huge learning curve for me, you know, especially, and even in Europe, it was a huge learning curve to go from North American culture to European culture. So I think for me, it was bridging that gap and understanding how to learn from both and you know, bring it into my own lifestyle.
You said there was a huge gap to come from the Americas and go to European cultures. What was the biggest gap there?
The conversation surrounding what we want to eat, where we're going to source the food, how we're going to source the food is very different. And I find that that's the gap that is missing in North America. the education behind the insecurity of food.
So you felt there was more clarity about that in Europe than there is in the States?
For sure.
Like, I wonder how that shows up in your work. Like, when you cook, is it a story that you're telling? Is it just creating a meal that you hope people enjoy? Like, how do you think about what you're doing when you're working as a chef?
I definitely think as chefs, we are storytellers. We are the middle people in the food industry as a whole. We're not the purveyors. We're not the suppliers. We're not the hardworking farmers that actually bring the food from earth, from sea to the table. You know, we're not the guests. We're the in-between. And I think it's up to us to storytell, to provoke emotion, provoke memories, to educate, to create a platform so that the food and the purveyors of the food and the land that produces both of them gets to be able to have their story told. And it is, I think it is up to us and up to chefs to continue that.
After leaving Kojin Momofuku, Eva launched a supper club called the Soy Luck Club, with a special curated menu inspired by her Chinese background. How do you think about your perspective when you're telling a story?
When I was traveling into my family's native lands, that's when I realized that the differences in authenticities. You know, let's say a bowl of congee, for instance. You know, what's authentic to me that was made by the community, the Chinatown community I grew up in America, by my aunties, by my grandmother, by my mom, by my family's moms, my friends' moms, who all grew up in America and have embraced the new authenticity that we have brought here through, you know, the immigrants, through our stories, through our struggles and what we've had to adapt here. That's authentic to us. But also, what my cousin is eating on the streets in Hong Kong is also authentic to him. That is completely different, you know? So it's very interesting as I'm learning the different layers of authenticity that exist within my own family, you know, within the same culture. So that's something that I'm questioning right now.
So I know you're in Canada, but you lived quite a bit in the United States. How do you think about how people understand Asian, I'll put that in air quotes, food in the Americas?
I think it's widely misinterpreted and misrepresented. At some point, all the different nationalities, different Asian nationalities that were struggling in different times, periods of times in America's history, as it slowly became erased and silenced, most of the majority of Americans are just learning about Asian Americans just because of how we look, our black hair. And so that got categorized much easier. It is easier to remember that than trying to remember and learn and dig up all the different stories of, you know, when the Japanese Americans were suffering, and then there were the Chinese Americans that were suffering. And because of that, that also affected a lot of the culture that we brought into the nation. And that includes food, music, culture, and so forth. I don't think it only just happens to Asian Americans. I think it happens to a lot of other different identities and nationalities that are also deemed as foreigners in America.
I appreciate that you brought up the idea of the discrimination and the hardships that different groups faced. And I kind of want to turn that back around to food and think about hierarchy a little bit. I know you studied some French cuisine. What was that like?
In the history of Western cuisine, it was a roller coaster, the ups and downs, the highs and lows of fine dining. And it's always revolved around French. And they created this golden era where, you know, all cooks and all chefs from my generation and, you know, the 10 years before that, you know, our lives revolved around it. It was everything we wanted to be. We wanted to be part of that. That all revolved around, you know, European cuisine, French cuisine. It didn't stop with me either. Like, for me, the moment I went to Europe was when I realized that, okay, this is no longer a part-time job. This is a career. And, it never crossed my mind once.
that this should be Asian cuisine or this should be another type of cuisine. You know, of course it made sense that, you know, it had to be in Paris. It had to be predominantly white male kitchen. You know, it made sense that at that time, my career, for at least me and part of my generation that I know, that that was deemed the best and that was what we had to go through. And, you know, 10, 15, 18 years after, even after being good at it, I still feel foreign to it.
What's the foreignness of it for you right now?
I think foreign is because the only nostalgia it provokes out of me is, you know, my apprentice years. You know, that's as far the memory goes back in my head when I'm cooking French food, you know, as compared to now as I am learning about, you know, food from my ancestors. When I think about when I'm cooking it, it provokes emotions and nostalgia beyond times that I can even remember.
I'm curious, is there a dish that really captures that sense you have of progression or authenticity for you?
I think I would turn to a humble bowl of congee. I think one time a food critic questioned me how to honor farm to table with Asian cuisine in North America. And my answer was, the bowl of greens that you're eating on the table was a bunch of greens that I bought from this older Asian lady just selling her produce next to this superstore, literally just on the streets with a tiny basket. And I explained to her, I'm like, she doesn't have a farm. She owns a small little, you know, front lawn with a couple lettuce, greens, and some kale and some Chinese veggies. But I will tell you that that bowl you're eating is as North American as it is, but also 100% authentically Asian and domestic. My generation and beyond are finding that voice to speak and explain how we can recreate that food authentically in our own lens, with the produce, with what is available, with what we grew up seeing every day here.
Speaking of congee, that brings up the question of congeegate, the whole thing around Karen Taylor, who's an acupuncturist, a white woman in Oregon, who
yes.
owns the Breakfast Cure, who gave herself the title of Queen of Congee. In case you missed it, Karen Taylor had written that she spent a lot of time, quote, modernizing congee for today's Western palate. She's one of several people accused of whitewashing traditional ethnic dishes in order to make more profits.
I don't say this lightly, but I don't think it's said enough. It's a privilege to jazz something so simple to make it more marketable to a population who's not even educated why it's so simple in the beginning. You know, congee fed all of China through famine, war, revolutions, bloodsheds. And it's because all, like, the land is based on water and rice. That was all that it can be based on. And certain regions are based on millet and water. But that's why it was born. It was out of poverty. It was out of, you know, instability. And it is a privilege to think that, you know, congee should be jazzed up with chia seeds and flax seeds and acai berries to take it away from the storytelling first. That's privilege.
Can you describe congee a bit for people who might not know what it is?
Congee is as simple as, you know, just cooking. It's a porridge texture, predominantly water and rice, based on different regions around China and what the resources have. Sometimes it's millet. Sometimes it's rice, quinoa, and millet. Some regions are purple, forbidden rice. But it is water and grain. And depending on what you have at home, you know, you eat it with chili oil, you eat it with pickles, with pork floss, little condiments, little garnishes, small amounts, very small amounts of meats and veggies are eaten with the congee. And again, it wasn't because of abundance. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't really culinary driven. It was more what you had available and what was gonna survive you through.
And when you eat congee, what does it elicit for you?
Comfort. That's the first thing that brings to mind, is comfort and convenience. For the most part, those two, comfort and convenience.
Obviously, you want people to enjoy your food, but do you have in mind the feeling that you want to create when you make congee for other people? Is that what you want to produce for them?
Yeah, there are dishes where I cook that I'm looking to invoke certain emotion. There are some that I truly want them to question the food itself. And then there is food that I cook to tell a story. And, you know, when I cook congee, depending on obviously what I flavor it or what garnishes I put on it, for the most part, I am trying to invoke nostalgia. You know, I want them to remember something comforting that their mom or their family made for them, or something they craved when it was cold and when they were sick.
And that sense of nostalgia is part of Eva's own journey as a chef. When she looks back on living with her family in Hawaii, she can taste and smell the memories.
Hawaii is like a mosh pit of flavors. You know, it's the one place in the world where you can have a hamburger patty over white rice with gravy fried egg and a mac salad on the side. I can't even, you know, if you smell any form of barbecue while you're walking, you know, any house that has their gate open or the barbecue is in sight, you can rock up and get a free meal and make friends for the rest of the night in that house, or go to multiple houses, you know. I think growing up in a culture like that, it's hard to not love the act of hospitality, the act of feeding, of storytelling through food. Because that was Hawaii, you know, you go down three blocks, you know, you go into a Filipino Hawaiian family and you're having caboodle feasts and you're learning, you know, what Filipino warriors used to eat, why we're eating on banana leaves with our hands. You know, you go down a couple more blocks, you go to a longtime Portuguese family that settled their roots in Hawaii for 45 years. And you're eating, you know, some really amazing salt cod and Portuguese sausages and, you know, malasadas for dessert. And this can go on. You know, there's so many different settlers in Hawaii, and you get to learn, and everyone's so welcoming. And I think as a chef, that is my number one foundation, the hospitality behind it. My food shows where I've been, who I am, and where I'm going with it. You know, just join me in my journey.
I happened to be in Portland when I spoke with Eva and with Von Diaz. I took the opportunity to ask them for restaurant recommendations. Who wouldn't ask two chefs for recommendations? I'd like to eat. And though I spoke to them at different times, they both gave me the same answer.
Her name is Nong, N-O-N-G, and then her dish is kamangai, which is chicken rice and Thai. I think it's about 10 or 15 years ago, she started in Portland with the smallest little cart. All she had was that one dish, that literally all she sold was chicken and rice. That was it. And she's one of the most hardworking, most adorable little ladies you'll ever meet. And she's a wonderful success stories.
So, of course, I had to go check it out.
I'm Nong Phun Suk Wathana. I'm the owner of Nong's Common Restaurants, specialized in Thai chicken and rice, based in Portland, Oregon.
I met with Nong at one of her sit-down locations. It was mid-morning, and she was getting ready to open for lunch.
I originally from Bangkok, Thailand, and came to the States in 2003 with $70 and two suitcases. And I work as a waitress at the numerous restaurants day and night. In 2009, I, with all the money that I have, I saved about $8,000 at the time. I bet it all on that one food cart, and it worked.
Yes. I'm happy it worked.
Yes.
Actually, Nong didn't start out wanting to work with food. She told me that she trained as a flight attendant. When it didn't go as well as she had hoped, she followed her partner at the time here to America. Then she had to find work.
You said a waitress.
Yes.
So were you working in food in Thailand, or you just, that was the easiest job to get here, or well, how did you end up being a waitress?
It was the easiest job I can get. It's the third week I'm in the States. I have no idea what's going on. I speak very little English, and it's my first job. But into food, my mom worked as a cook at a restaurant, and her family and different type of style. Mm. Like her brother, good at Chinese food. He worked as a cook at the restaurant in London. My mom worked as a cook at Foodland, it's Western grocery store. And her sister is very good at cooking, drinking food. They all like really good cooks. And my mom just teach me how to cook, and I didn't think it's anything special, but it's just something that we have to do.
And then you were saving up money. When did you know you wanted to do a food cart?
I wanted to have a restaurant, but with $8,000, I couldn't afford to open a restaurant. And back then, the food cart is not popular 12 years ago. As an immigrant, people my age, they will go to school, and I chose not to go because I didn't want to have a student loan. So I kind of, in my own head, I thought that I'm gonna do it my way and I'm gonna make it, I'm gonna achieve something. But I don't know what it is. I'm a very ambitious person. But I just keep working. I work at 4 or 5 restaurants. I work morning, lunch shift, and then go to another restaurant for dinner shift 7 days a week. I don't have days off. And that was day that I feel dark, like I don't think I will make it anywhere. I will be at this restaurant forever. That's days like that. So before the food cart, I would say that the first 6 years was hard. The journey of immigrant is not supposed to be easy, but I guess I got used to it. I mean, even today, I get treated different, but I accept it as part of life. And I would say that the experience, I thought it was hard because I didn't know like what's America like. But when I come here, if we speak with accent or we don't speak very good English, you get treated different. Like example, as a waitress, like we will look at tips, right? There'll be time that like we do everything that we supposed to do, and some people will tip 25 cents and we will take it personally. And I used to judge my work, also judge myself by those tips, which is not true. Later on in life that I met people that they are nicer. You know, the first 7 years, for me in America, I wish I had met you. But again, it wouldn't form me who I am. Mm.
When she had saved enough, she bought her first food cart. She spent months perfecting the process of making Thai chicken and rice, finding the right birds, poaching the meat, cooking the rice in the broth, and creating the sauce.
So apparently it's the best place for chicken and rice in Portland.
Oh, thank you. I'm honored.
can you tell me a little bit about the dish?
Yes. It is Thai chicken and rice called khao man kai. And at the time, 12 years ago, as far as I know, there was nobody was doing it yet. And I saw a potential. About the dish, it's originated from Hainan in China. I think in around like 1900 or something, like that's a lot of Chinese people immigrate to Thailand and work as in the rice farm. Rice farmer, the Hainanese chicken and rice. The food for like worker food, it has protein, it has chicken, it has rice, and it has the sauce. So they eat that and they have like power to carry 50 pounds of bag of rice all day. Chinese people eat for medicine. A lot of their food is about what it do to the health. And Thai people is, I think now more about that, but like we are about flavor.
You want it to taste good. That's,
flavor. Yeah, so like flavor. Like, I'm
me
like,
too, I'm about flavor. Yeah.
So I think they found that all the Hainanese chicken, right, is bland. So they make, Thai people make the twist to be like flavor bomb because it's boiled chicken and use the stock that boil the chicken, cook the rice. It actually, you create the texture. And then the whole flavor is from the sauce. The Thai sauce, it's the fermented soybean mixed with Thai chili, ginger, garlic, pickled syrup. And I think it cut through the chicken fat that is in the rice or in the broth. Like you cook the whole chicken and it have the soup to like balance the whole dish together.
Today, Nong's business has expanded from a food cart to two brick and mortar locations and a business selling her signature sauce and other kinds of merchandise. But that first food cart, it was pretty small, like the menu at the time, and with pretty limited hours.
It was a 6x6 trailer, very tiny. It fit two burner, one rice cooker and one rice warmer, and three compartment sink and hand wash. I always wanted to be different, and at that time there was about like a lot of Thai food already, and they have like similar menu, but the khao mang kai nobody did it, yeah, chicken and rice. At the time, a lot of restaurants, they have a lot of items on the menu, but my food cart had only one item on the menu, so I took all the choice away, and I also opened at 10 a.m. until I sold out. So if you come at 3 and you want food, I say, no, I sold out. So it was my rebel.
Okay.
Yeah. And for some reason, 10 years ago, it paid off. I got noticed.
It certainly did.
As Nong says, her food cart didn't take off right away. There was a time when people didn't understand Nong's food or her approach.
I remember like the customer look very hip and all that, but that's all like, oh, maybe like look different. They're like, I'm not sure who they are. But after 3 days, people don't understand the menu. On the menu, it says chicken and rice, egg tart sauce, and chicken liver. And people see chicken liver, and the guy would like make the face like, ew, like in front of me. Or like, oh, you don't have pad thai, or you don't have like salad rolls. So that's time that I was questioning myself. My goal was that that's the same people in around that block. And that's only, back then, that's only a few food carts, like less than 10. So my hope is that once a week, they come to eat chicken and rice. So I have to remember their name, their order. It took about 7 months, and that was day that I didn't sell out. I have to throw the food away. And I remember that one day I count the money. It was $70. The sale was $70, and I have to throw the food away. And I look at that money, and I ask myself, am I happy? But I look at this $70. My answer was, I'm happy, because I feel that it was my craft. That make this $70, and I don't have to depend on tips to judge myself, and it's the $70 that I'm proud.
How authentic is it? What does it mean for it to be authentic? It's Chinese food,
yes,
the Thai twist,
yes,
and that you put together.
Is exactly.
Is it authentic? And what does it mean for it to be authentic now?
I think it's the cook, whatever the cook wanna serve. But if we use the word authentic as a gimmick for marketing, I think that all the mom and pop shop out there, they want to serve what they cook, but they're scared. Example, we used to serve authentic chicken and rice that we make like with the skin on. But in America, they don't know what chicken skin is. They don't know what that chicken have legs and thigh. They only know chicken breasts that cook to dry, the super cook. But the reason was that those cook and those restaurants scared that the customer will sue them that if they serve raw food. So they just cook until it's dead, dry. But it actually come from fear. I serve, for my experience, like chicken and rice, we used to serve skin on. That's when a gentleman eat the food and he left the chicken skin on and he throw it to my face at the food cart. And he said, "This is not what you do in America." I got scared too. Uh-huh. And unfortunately, it make me change too. So now we didn't serve the skin on. If the Asian come, they're like, "Where the skin?" So I think authentic is what you want to cook, I think.
So it's authentic to you. You made it authentic because you're the cook.
Yes, and that's what you want to serve, and this is what you want to present, and that's your craft.
But now you have two shops?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And a sauce, a bottle of Nong sauce, sale at grocery store along West Coast.
Okay.
To be the entrepreneur or business owner, it's one of the hardest things to achieve. If I can make it, you can make it too. Sometimes I feel redundant of my story. Came from America, Thailand, $70 and two suitcases is redundant. I say the same story, but it is the true story. Mm-hmm. It's my story. Uh-huh. I'm a one-hit wonder, chicken and rice.
Because you only need one.
Food defines boundaries and can take us across them. What does it take to create these experiences? When people produce, sell, and serve food, they are providing sustenance, but they're also offering and giving a lot more of themselves. I love going out to restaurants. And if you're anything like me, there's nothing like being out with friends or family and having a great experience around food and drink. And maybe knowing a little bit more about the food that you're consuming together will add even more to that experience. That's it for this episode. I'm Brian Lowry. Know What You See is produced by PRX in collaboration with the Stanford Graduate School of Business. Our production team is Jocelyn Gonzalez, Amy Chan, and Jonathan Cabral from PRX Productions. Executive producer from the Stanford Graduate School of Business is Bernadette Clavier, with content production by Katie Wallace. For more about me or the show, go to knowwhatyousee.com. Thanks for listening. And remember, know what you see.